Hey there, this is Paul Roberts of the Security Ledger. If security and the Internet of Things are your thing, I wanted to let you know about a great event Security Ledger is hosting on June 19th in Boston. It's the fifth Security of Things Forum. It's a full day of great content on securing the Internet of Things. If you're interested in learning more and either presenting or just attending the forum, text the word THINGS, that's THINGS, to the number 345-345 on your cell phone. That's THINGS to 345-345. You can also point your web browser to the event website, securityofthings.com, to learn more, to submit an abstract for a talk, or to register. Hello and welcome to the Security Ledger podcast. I'm Paul Roberts, editor-in-chief at the Security Ledger. In this week's show, number 87, the United Kingdom released a comprehensive report calling for big changes in the Internet of Things when it comes to security. But is the report dead on arrival? We talked to a UK Internet of Things security expert to find out. Also, there's a growing number of hacker groups specializing in breaking into and manipulating industrial control systems. We speak with Joe Slowick, an adversary hunter at the firm Dragos Security, to find out who some of these groups are. But first, if the utopian vision of the internet that emerged in the 1990s was that it was a platform that would connect and give voice to billions of voiceless and powerless people in the world, what's emerged in the last 10 years looks a lot more dystopian. Governments in Russia, China, Syria, Egypt, Turkey, and other countries have bent the internet to serve decidedly undemocratic and repressive agendas. Rather than being a record of human thought and expression, the internet is starting to look a lot more Orwellian. At least those were the thoughts that I had when speaking this week with Priscilla Moriucci, the Director of Strategic Threat Development at the firm Recorded Future. Moriucci's behind a bunch of research that Recorded Future has released in the last 6 months, looking at China's National Vulnerability Database, or CNNVD. It's that country's official record of software vulnerabilities, much like the US's National Vulnerability Database. But in research released last week, Recorded Future warned that the Chinese authorities are apparently altering the publication dates of reports on serious and exploitable software vulnerabilities. This behavior, Moriucci says, fits with a much larger pattern of behavior in China, where the government uses its control over the internet to rewrite truth and shape reality for its billions of citizens. To start out our conversation, I asked Priscilla to talk about the history of Recorded Future's research into China's National Vulnerability Database and what the company has found so far.
My name is Priscilla Moriucci. I'm a director of strategic threat development at Recorded Future. So last fall, we started off looking at what we could find out by looking at US NVD and China's NVD. The data, you know, that they publish, what we could learn about the timing, any publication lags and all that stuff. So first thing we kind of learned was broadly, China's NVD is faster than the US NVD when it comes to publishing vulnerabilities. They're more comprehensive. Their database is more comprehensive as well. At the time, they had about 1,700 more vulnerabilities published than US NVD. And that was pretty much a function of the way the two NVDs work. We discovered that CNNVD is run by the Ministry of State Security, which is sort of like China's equivalent of the CIA. We saw that presenting a conflict of interest for NVD because vulnerability reporting is essentially a transparency process, right, where you're trying to put out as a public service, right, to citizens and companies, you know, information about vulnerabilities so that, you know, these citizens and companies can secure their own networks, right? So that we see that as a transparency process and intelligence service as being an inherently a security or covert controlling process. So We figured it would be difficult to balance the two mandates. And it turns out that we were right. So over the course of studying CNNVD last fall, we identified this group that we called the outliers. So this was a group of CVEs where NVD was fast to publication and CNNVD was very slow to publication. So it's this, what we called like this publication lag this time between NVD publication and CNNVD publication that was one of the primary tools that we used in our analysis of CNNVD. And we got a number of interesting conclusions, you know, or data points that sort of propelled us to the conclusion in the end, right, that the MSS was influencing China's vulnerability publications and delaying them to allow for their own assessment in their own operations.
So you saw this really clear pattern, in other words, of faster disclosure and reporting, except in this particular category of highly useful, remotely exploitable vulnerabilities in common platforms. Where, curiously, it was actually a lot slower, right?
Exactly, yeah. So we had these outlier ones that were much slower. Also, broadly, CNNVD took longer to publish high-threat vulnerabilities than low-threat mm-hmm. ones, mm-hmm. which is the opposite of NVD, right? So NVD puts all this time and resource into putting out high-threat vulnerabilities very quickly,
right.
And CNNVD lags on those. CNNVD is also slow to publish vulnerabilities with known exploits for them. NVD is generally fast in that category as well. Mm-hmm. So these just all were kind of adding up for us and sort of making the case for us that, you know, the MSS was interfering in this process.
Fast forward a couple months, you went back and did some more research on, again, that CNNVD data and found kind of curious pattern of behavior, right?
Yeah. So for that group of outliers we had identified, we went back to look at them and see if anything had changed. What we found was that CNNVD had manipulated the initial publication date to essentially cover up or eliminate the publication lag. This would essentially hide the evidence of MSS influence and sort of any other processes that would create this publication lag in the first place. And it would limit the methods that we were using and other researchers could use to possibly anticipate Chinese APT behavior. So they essentially manipulated their own data, you know, to get rid of this sort of data leakage, right? And that this data leakage was giving people information possibly about their operations.
And now this is for the vulnerabilities that you had already noted. So it's very easy to say, aha, when we looked at it on this date, it had this release date. Now we're looking at it 3 months later and it's got a totally different one. Could they be more surreptitious going forward, or is it going to be harder to note this type of covering behavior going forward or not?
So, I mean, there are a number of things that they could do and a number of ways that we can kind of counter it as researchers. So first, the thing that we have been doing is keeping track of the dates when CVEs are created, altered, and not changing and updating our base. So we have sort of a series of dates, and to keep the integrity of the data, where you keep all the dates that the changes have been made to the CVE and sort of not update them. So that's kind of the number one method that we're using. For the MSS, though, I'm sort of interested to see how they're going to approach this going forward. They sort of been called out on it because they could do a number of things. One, they could keep backdating, you know, these outliers as they're identified. Or two, they could just post CVE, right? Initial posting with a backdated date, right? So say they could post a CVE in March of 2018, but just backdate it so that the entry says they published it in like December of 2017. And that will be a little bit more difficult to keep track of. That time you'll have to pull on the web, right, database, as well as, kind of parse the data.
I mean, this raises a bigger question, really, which exists here in the United States as well, which is about this notion of vulnerability equities, right? That, you know, nation state actors, including the United States, on the one hand, have a duty to the public to help keep, you know, computer systems safe. On the other hand, have an interest in powerful, exploitable software holes that they might use as part of their intelligence operations, right? How does the behavior of China's CNNVD and their intelligence services in this way kind of play into that or affect things on in this country where, again, vulnerability equities have been a contentious topic as well?
It's interesting, too, because we're talking about sort of two sets of vulnerabilities. So for the U.S., like the VEP, the vulnerability equities process, that applies to vulnerabilities that the U.S. intelligence community has discovered on its own, right, and is wondering about whether they should be reported to the public or not, right? This process that we have seen is for the MSS to evaluate vulnerabilities that the public already know exists, right? So that information is already out there, right, for malicious actors, hackers, right? Anyone who would want to, you know, exploit networks. So really there's this extra risk that China is levying upon people that use its data And we're going to check and make sure we can't use it in our own operations. And maybe we will use it in our own operations before we even publish it. So, I really see that as sort of the triumph of the security and the secrecy mandate and the complete sort of wiping out of the transparency mandate for CNVD.
Who uses CNVD? I mean, who are its consumers and readers?
My understanding is it's mainly used by Chinese companies or Asian regional companies. It's becoming more widely used in China, though, to be fair. Before that, we started looking at like the speed. I think it was sort of just seen as as another NVD, right? And another interesting resource. I'd say it's certainly useful still in that in terms of speed, but to know that it can't be your only data source. And that what you're getting from CNVD, might not be much of the whole truth. I think the other aspect to the sort of why, like why would China want to manipulate this information that's already in the public domain, kind of gets to the mission of the MSS. So its rough equivalent is the CIA, right? But that foreign intelligence is only half of its mission. The other half is this domestic control and monitoring mandate. And this fits right within right, that half of their mandate, which is controlling the information environment, right, in China and tracking people and its citizens, right? And to us, this is more an example of how they're trying to leverage their own information to control the information environment in China, as opposed to, how they're seeking to, control foreigners, right, or the international community.
Does this put pressure maybe on the US and Western governments to be more prompt and forthcoming with publishing vulnerabilities on their own national vulnerability databases to be a database of record, as it were, for some of these vulnerabilities?
Certainly, for US NVD, right? When we went back and looked at, just a couple weeks ago when we examined US NVD data, for example, we saw that NVD was getting faster, right? That their lag time had improved from 33 to 30 days, right? And that they had started to tackle some of this backlog of CVEs, almost about 1,000 in the past 6 months, that they had never reported on. So it looks like from a data perspective that possibly NVD could be taking up some of that, the mantle of the CVE of record, right? In terms of trying to catch up, trying to be faster and being the most comprehensive.
Recorded Future's a threat intelligence firm. Do we have any information that these high-risk vulnerabilities that they are sitting on and presumably analyzing or assessing for their usefulness are then used or have been used in targeted attacks?
Yeah, so we've got the sort of two I kind of alluded to earlier. One is 2017-0199. It's the Microsoft Office or the Microsoft Suite vulnerability. That one was very, very popular last year. It was used by a number of actors outside of China, Chinese actors as well. And that one, that was where we had seen the Chinese APT actors use an exploit for that vulnerability during the publication lag. If we're sort of tying this to the like, why should I care? My argument there is kind of over the next 20 to 30 years, China's going to become the dominant economy, right? And arguably, one of the dominant players in the world. We really see their manipulation of this benign data set, right, as an indicator of how they're approaching this, the internet, right, and communications with the world. So just for kind of your average person, we're following this stuff, right, because we want indicators on how China is going to treat and interact the rest of the world with the rest of the world in the future. And this is just sort of one more data point that shows us that transparency and freedom of speech are not going to be at the top of their list in the future either.
Priscilla Moriucci, thank you so much for coming back on and talking to us on the Security Ledger podcast.
Okay, of course. Thanks, Paul.
It's been almost a decade since the Stuxnet worm woke up the world to the threat of malware attacks on industrial control systems, but it's only in the last couple of years that in-the-wild attacks on critical infrastructure have become common. Hacks on the Ukraine's electric grid and, more recently, on an industrial refining facility in the Middle East show that malicious actors and nation-states are interested in poking around industrial control system environments, if not destroying them outright. What is the state of hacking for industrial control systems? In this second part of the Security Ledger podcast, we sat down with Joe Slowick, an adversary hunter at the firm Dragos Security, which specializes in securing industrial control systems. Dragos has recently come out with a report identifying no fewer than 5 groups that are active in the ICS space. To start off our conversation, I asked Joe to talk about how Dragos identifies industrial control system hacking groups and how it distinguishes them from other kinds of malicious online actors.
So my name is Joe Slowick, and I am an adversary hunter for Dragos. What's interesting to note, if you look at the report, one of the major incidents, probably the major incident of 2017 in the ICS space, was the Trisis event impacting a safety system in the Middle East. And we don't have an activity group for that because our information on that is really limited to just the single malware sample and its supporting library files and binary files that were uploaded to the controller in question. So when we say that we've identified 5 groups active in this space, we already know that there are more than likely more out there just because we have a high profile attack for which we can't make that level of assignment yet.
So when you're putting these together, I mean, what is the collection of information or indicators that typically gives you confidence, okay, we know this group as apart from other groups?
So there's a theoretical model, it was based off a paper that came out almost 10 years ago, the Diamond Model for Incident Response. Highlights activity by 4 cardinal points. So you have an adversary, there is some bad guy out there, and they're connected to some victim entity via infrastructure and capabilities. And really looking for 2 or more unique endpoints in that model, you know, at a high level sort of is what we define an activity group by. So in the case of Trisis, you know, we kind of have an idea of the victim. We have a better idea about the capability. But after that, we really don't have enough information to say this is any. It's like trying to draw a line with 1 point. You're not going to get anywhere very fast. And we just didn't have enough dots in that case. Whereas with the other 5, either through direct observables or through other information we were able to gather through partners and collaborating with some stakeholders that we work with, we did have sufficient information to say, hey, there's a specific adversary that uses these capabilities or shares this sort of infrastructure, and they're targeting these industrial verticals. And, you know, thus we can make a higher confidence claim that this is a distinct set of behaviors that belongs to this entity.
The threat groups that you sketch out seem to be somewhat regionally based. So you've got some that seem to be operating mostly in Europe. You've got a couple that seem to be focused on the Middle East. Do these groups, by and large, line up with nation-state entities? Or is there any evidence that there are people interested in compromising industrial control system networks who are not affiliated with a government or a military, merely doing it for commercial purposes?
That's a really good question. Digging into that, the idea of, well, what's the point has to come up if you're trying to understand, well, why would someone want to turn off the power in Kiev for a couple of hours or compromise a safety system which could kill someone at a gas plant in Saudi Arabia or something along those lines? And short of doing things just to see the world burn sort of motivations, which thankfully we don't see too much of that. Typically, terrorism only works if you let the world know that you did something for this reason to advertise your grievances and cause, that, you know, there's no financial motivation or financial gain to be had in any of these items. So that seems to weed out a lot of criminal activity right from the start. And if you look at the areas involved, so, you know, where do we see most of our activity taking place or revolving around? So Middle East, Europe, especially focusing on the Ukraine area, a little bit in East Asia, and then the US pops up because we're a nice big target for lots of things and aligns very nicely to, you know, what you would say the threat environment in terms of conflict zones would be. So lots of people don't like each other in the Middle East. Hence, it's not surprising to see people trying to poke around in each other's critical infrastructure in that region.
So these attacks have really just become another front in geopolitical conflicts between different countries or collections of countries.
That's certainly quite possible. So the one case where we are very comfortable in saying this activity belongs to nation-state activity would be our Electrum group, which was responsible for the crash override attack in Ukraine in 2016. That case, based upon information we've been able to collect and working with some partners, they are directly aligned with Russian strategic interests. They seem to have links with the Sandworm advanced persistent threat, Sandworm being a FireEye term, but there's some overlap in how those groups operate site or in their targeting. So that's one case where, unless we're dramatically missing the mark on this one, you know, it seems as though that group is directly aligned with, like I said, Russian strategic interests. Of course, having said that, looking at some of the other recent reporting on activity, you have groups like this Internet Research Agency, completely different topic from industrial controls, but private group or a private company, so to speak, that is also acting on behalf of a nation state strategic interest. So just because it happens to do something that aligns very well with someone's stated or implied strategic interests, still a little murky who exactly it would be, but at the very least from an intent capability, we're confident enough for the crash override event and Electrum as a group that that is the case.
You know, that 2016 attack, there was a similar attack against Ukraine in 2015, also targeting the electric grid. And then, of course, there was the NotPetya malware attack, which was less targeted on industrial control systems. Should we see all of those, all three of those incidents, as linked back to the same group, or is there some piling on here?
There's potentially some piling on here. I know I've seen reports that the NotPetya event has been linked to the same sort of actors responsible for other events in Ukraine. Having looked at NotPetya a little bit, it's, you know, a little bit outside of our scope, although NotPetya ended up having some industrial control impacts. We didn't have enough information to go on to link it to anything that we at Dragos are observing directly. You know, it is interesting in looking at it from a behavioral standpoint. You know, we have a group like Electrum, which is very laser-like focused on industrial control specific techniques, capabilities, and targets, and NotPetya doesn't seem to align well with them as an entity. That doesn't mean that they're not associated with a group, you know, some other Ukrainian effects team that's trying to cause chaos there, but it doesn't seem like it's the same team that was responsible for the 2016 Ukraine incident and then went on to launch NotPetya. They just seem too separate in terms of intent and the technology behind it.
Yeah, I mean, you bring up NotPetya. It was, you know, malware that mostly infected Windows systems. It spread by a couple different mechanisms, including a software update to a financial software package. Not ICS malware specifically, not targeted at industrial control systems, but obviously had a huge impact at firms like Maersk and FedEx and, you know, Mondelez Candy that obviously do run industrial facilities and use this software. How should we think about NotPetya then, considering that it took out a lot of serious infrastructure, particularly in the shipping arena?
Right. I think this is a new trend that we're starting to see, and it's one that so far has been targets of opportunity or sort of spreading beyond initial intention. So NotPetya initiated with a compromised update for Ukrainian accounting software. And then from there, due to business links and just the interconnectivity of things, ended up spreading to places like Maersk and Mondelez, et cetera. But if you look at the underlying tactics, techniques, and procedures behind NotPetya, you've demonstrated a very potent capability that, you know, we first started seeing in a very basic form in the Mirai botnet creator, where just going against Internet of Things objects with hard-coded passwords and then spreading from there. And then you had WannaCry, a little more advanced, like, let's take these exploits and go after anything that's exposing version 1 of SMB and compromise those and then move on to the next target. NotPetya added a further refinement on that by including exploits, but also integrating credential capture and replay so that if you had a host that was compromised, Windows credentials could be harvested, allowing for potential spread to machines that weren't vulnerable to one of the Eternal series exploits or something else, but just happened to be on the network and someone else logged into the machine, leading all the way up, and this isn't an ICS impact, but I could definitely tell a story or see a scenario where someone could repurpose this malware for an ICS impact, the Olympic Destroyer event, where you remove all of the exploits and simply work with credential capture and credential replay to pivot throughout a network. And if you look at the way that ICS networks function now, there's still this myth, this conception that, well, ICS is isolated from the internet and there's not a lot of connectivity, so you don't have to worry as much. But modern operations demand, whether it's the engineer who needs to VPN or RDP in to manage machines from his workstation in an office, as opposed to from a plant floor, the vendor that needs to provide some remote maintenance or troubleshooting, or even just the business intelligence server in the IT network that needs data from the ICS network just to do things like billing calculations. There's a lot more connectivity than is often realized until you see what impacts take place as a result of these items that were able to spread automatically. And it hasn't happened yet, or at least no one's been able to detect it yet, but one of the typically hardest items in order to bring about an ICS impact is, well, first you have to compromise an IT network, then you have to pivot into the ICS network somehow, gain some measure of persistence there, identify what you need to target, and then deliver your impact, like in a crash override or a choices event. But if you can automate some of those steps through a self-propagating worm, which seems like a Back to the Future moment, because the very first piece of ICS destructive software that we know of, the Stuxnet worm, did just that. It, you know, spread via USB keys, and it used a bunch of very special exploits as part of its process. But at the end of the day, it was really trying to do, you know, from a spreading perspective, not all that dissimilar from a NotPetya, Bad Rabbit, or Olympic Destroyer. Just let me spread through these networks. Stuxnet was obviously very refined in that it only delivered its payload on very select machines. Whereas, you know, Olympic Destroyer, NotPetya, Bad Rabbit, et cetera, were indiscriminate in where they were delivering their impacts. But it really emphasizes a potential playbook for how to wreak havoc in these environments because of the increased level of connectivity that's available to an adversary.
With Maersk, I think you had tens of thousands, I think 40,000 systems that needed to be rebuilt. What's going wrong within sophisticated global organizations like this that you could have a firm so utterly dismantled by a piece of malware to the point where they're tracking shipments with pen and paper, that their IT network has effectively been destroyed?
Right. I mean, first, it's fair to say, well, they're not the first and certainly not the only, nor will they be the last. Sony ended up having a very bad day just along the same lines, and
yeah,
other organizations just, you know, how does the impact get so large? That's a good question. I have a feeling that Maersk, you know, I'm not trying to call them out or whatever, but they're probably not the only ones that would be vulnerable to such an extent. They just happen to be the ones where things played out in such a fashion to cause such a disruption. So you look at just the common ways of operating, either out of convenience sake or, you know, old habits lingering into a new era, whether it's administrators reusing passwords on local machines, not using two-factor authentication schema when it's available. For, you know, this is one thing that comes up in the IT space, ICS space all the time, is patch management. So ICS patch management is a non-trivial item, whether it's, you know, waiting for vendors to approve something, or do you even have hardware that can be patched and upgraded in the first place? IT should be more flexible, although it is interesting if you look at the Spectre and Meltdown fallout, where you had the very patches that were supposed to fix a problem ended up causing a lot of problems for people along the way. So there's still the need to research and make sure that vulnerability patching, but it's hard to say or tell an IT, especially a very large IT environment, that, hey, apply this as soon as possible. And if it just so happens to blue screen a bunch of your machines, which causes us the same or maybe even worse impact as if you'd gotten infected by malware, so be it. So it's a really hard problem to address. You know, certainly Maersk got caught in a very bad situation. I'm sure there are other factors that led to them being so uniquely impacted by this environment. But really just starting out with the basics, I don't know, except they're not very basic. If they were basic, everyone would be doing them. But the higher level strategic concepts of safe network design and functionality. So proper segmentation, trying to minimize privilege links between different network enclaves, especially when you're talking about something like an IT and an ICS network, attempting to embrace things like two-factor authentication where possible, or moving towards other authentication schema so that something as simple as running Mimikatz doesn't allow someone to then pivot throughout your entire network and cause chaos. Even things such as having robust and well-maintained backup policies. And lastly, planning for these events to occur. It's always easy to say after the fact, well, how does your disaster recovery plan work? Or, you know, did you tabletop a situation such as this? Well, you should have. But, you know, we're all very busy, and organizations typically are just trying to keep the lights on from an IT perspective that doesn't afford that much time to go into a, you know, almost theoretical, seemingly low payoff approach like running a tabletop exercise or some of these other sorts of activities that could identify these weaknesses in advance. But the key behind here is, instead of, you know, racing to trying to figure these things out in the moment, like Maersk, and from what I've read about how their IT personnel reacted, they all deserve medals. But having a plan when things get that bad, or at least close to that bad, seems to be a vital thing to reduce that mean time to restoration. Because one thing that should be emphasized as well is everyone's going to get compromised at some point. The scope of that compromise can certainly be different, but, you know, you don't get to pick whether or not an adversary decides that you are the entity that's going to be hit by something. And in the case of an indiscriminate worm, you have no choice whatsoever. But what you do have a choice about is, how are you prepared, and what steps have you taken for when that eventuality occurs? What do you do about it? And, you know, certainly focusing on prevention is good, but also focusing on what do you do for remediation is vital, so that in a Maersk-like situation, you can get things back up and running to some measure as quickly as possible.
That said, there are some upstream issues for customers as well. And in your report, one of your reports, you definitely raised some concerns both about the quality of software patches that are coming, particularly from industrial control system vendors, and also that the guidance, the sort of workarounds or remediation that is often accompanying ICS vulnerabilities is perfunctory and not very useful for customers. I mean, what are customers supposed to do if the quality of the patches they're getting from vendors is not necessarily adequate to the problem, and if the guidance that they're getting is also not particularly useful?
So the patch quality item, I don't know if I can really think of some way of resolving that. I mean, it's something to call attention to, and then as a community, we can hopefully move forward to get a better understanding that, you know, just because you've patched this one instance of this vulnerability, that understanding that, no, it's this underlying library used in these 15 other firmware variants that must be fixed. That's an important point to get to. And, you know, that's something that, you know, hopefully as a ICS security community between vendors and researchers, we can solve that. The recommendations and mitigations item, though, that's something that we can do right now. It's also one thing that really bothers me, because it does seem like so much that accompanies a vulnerability report is very perfunctory in nature, but whenever you actually start thinking about it, is useless or irrelevant to the situation at hand. What I think we really need to do, and what we try to do over at Dragos at least, is, you know, dig into these and understand, well, what's actually targeted here? Is something, if a vulnerability, it requires that you be authenticated to the machine in question in order to bring about an exploit situation, well, you've already lost, as far as I'm concerned, because if the adversary has access to the device in question, they can do whatever they want. Mm-hmm. But when you start looking into things like remote code execution vulnerabilities or remotely exploitable denial of service capabilities, now you start getting into areas where, okay, we need to start framing these in a realistic fashion, and what steps are necessary or are actionable to both allow for continued operations, because you're talking about environments that will operate for months at a time before they're able to go down to apply a patch in many instances, but at the same time make sure that they're as secure as possible. So that's where really adopting a defense in depth approach, which it's a hackneyed term by now, but for as much as we're familiar with it and getting sick of it, perhaps it still seems like there's a long way we can go towards implementing it better, especially in environments like industrial controls. So when I talk about the greater interconnectivity between IT and ICS, well, yes, there's greater connectivity, but it doesn't have to be an any-to-any sort of situation. You can shape and direct this traffic so that all of your devices have to go through a proxy server, or all of your devices have to go through, or all of your engineers have to go through a jump host, or other sorts of ways to narrow at least the number of these communication pathways down so that you can get a better handle on monitoring and limiting communication. Making sure that firewall rules are written appropriately instead of just saying have a firewall is an important nuance to add, so that you can maintain the functionality as best as possible while locking down and reducing the attack surface to the greatest degree possible at the same time.
Okay, Joseph Slowick, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us on the Security Ledger podcast. It was great having you.
Yes, it was a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
And finally, the UK government is just the latest to issue a report raising alarms about insecure devices that are connected to the Internet of Things. A new report out from the UK's Department for Digital, Culture, Media and Sport on Wednesday called for joint government and industry action, quote, as a matter of urgency. It also argues for a fundamental shift in the burden of securing connected devices from consumers to the manufacturers of those devices. That sounds like good advice, but our final guest, Ken Monroe of the firm Pentest Partners, thinks that it isn't worth the paper it's written on. In this final segment, Ken and I talk about the new report, what it gets right, and where it falls short.
Hello, Paul. How are you doing?
Good. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, he's fine. He's in the car at the moment, but it's all good.
So, Ken, this is the UK government's first big statement on Internet of Things security. I note that you are both an Internet of Things security researcher and a UK citizen. So who better to talk to? Maybe to start out, could you tell me what impact you think this new report is going to have?
Next to zero. It's just another standard. What we need now are not standards. We've got plenty of great standards already. So we've got GSMA, BSI, we've got Iron the Cavalry, US FDA put out standards. But loads of great standards. What we don't have is enforcement.
And there wasn't much about enforcement. There weren't many teeth in this report, certainly.
No, there were none. And that's my biggest problem is. So I'm very involved with the IoT Security Foundation, who are very involved in writing the standard. And I think this has been a huge missed opportunity to have involvement from government. And what government do well is regulation and legislation. I think the opportunity has been missed.
And why is that, in your opinion, if you were kind of on the inside? Was it lack of will or pushback from, you know, manufacturers or the private sector? Or why not put some teeth into this?
I think there was a lack of ambition. I think there's perhaps a lack of understanding. And I think it's the wrong time. I don't think the UK government was ready to regulate. I think, you know, very much in the same way as the US, they're open to relatively light-touch market regulation and hope the market will sort itself out. I think in this particular case, because of the multinational nature of the supply chain for IoT, regulation was required.
Is there anything meaningful, important, noteworthy in what is in the report?
No.
It's going to be a short conversation.
I'm really angry about it, actually, but it's a condensed version of other standards. And I think it was all it's done got some... a bit of media attention. I don't think there's anything of significant value in the report that isn't already in the public domain, that hasn't been already published by noteworthy bodies. So I don't think it adds anything. I'm really angry about it.
What, in your mind, would be the best path? Let's just think or talk in terms of the UK government. Would be the best path to meaningful regulations and an enforcement of connected device security, both for consumers and ideally for, you know, industry as well.
Okay, so we could take the recommendations of the report as a starting point, and they're a good starting point, don't get me wrong. You know, so like most of the standards out there, they're actually based on some really good ideas. But what needs to happen, or what should have happened, is that those foundations should have been the basis of regulation, and if the regulation wasn't followed by manufacturers, enforcement should have followed.
Is this an area where, I mean, the UK government, like the US government, other governments already do this for other categories of devices, right? Whether they're automobiles or medical devices or planes and that type of thing, right?
So it certainly does. So a great example is the US Food and Drug Administration has published mandatory requirements of smart medical technology. You know, what a great example of how government can work well with industry to go, do you know what? This stuff is life-threatening. It's important. With the government, we can do something about it.
Yeah. What do you think it's going to take to get there? If you're saying, well, the UK government is not ready, we have a government that is obviously not enthusiastic about government regulation of the market. What will it take, do you think, for us to get there?
There are other options. So I don't know if you saw the draft US Senate bill that came out a little while back about the regulation of smart devices.
Yeah, we talked about it.
Yeah, it's a really good framework, really simple. And what it did is it influenced government buyers, which is a really important market. So if you know, the one thing the government has control of is the government, right? And if the government says you can't buy stuff that isn't secure, that doesn't comply with some basic standards, you can't have it. And that influences the whole market's buying habits. So that's something really cool that the UK government could have done.
I mean, one of the things you've pointed out in your research is that many of these connected products are really assemblies of different things. There's the physical product, but then there's almost always some kind of a mobile application and then a cloud service in back of the mobile application. And as you pointed out, the supply chain for these, even just the endpoint, the product itself is often quite long. Where do you start with all this? Where do you get the biggest bang for your buck security-wise? Is it on the software development side or the supply chain side?
The most critical mistake an IoT vendor can make is choose the wrong chip that they build into their product. They choose the wrong hardware. It's very, very difficult to fix that in the field. So that's the most critical mistake you can make, because you're then committed to a product recall because you can't fix it remotely. We see bad chipsets get into the market all the time. The great thing is actually that once you fix that one, the biggest win after that is probably your API. Because if the API's got a problem, you've got a problem with all of your product, as in the hacker can steal your consumer data from all of the products.
Okay, so I mean, if this was mostly public relations on the part of the UK government without much substance to it, in some ways, does this set us back? Does it create the illusion within the UK anyway that things are happening and the government is on top of this problem when in point of fact, nothing meaningful has happened and we're exactly where we were before?
Yeah, so if anything, we've got a false perception in the market that it's being fixed and it's not. All that's happened is PR about now the standard has made it into the market. And it makes it look as if the government's doing good things, but actually nothing's changed and nothing will change until regulation comes. I'm pleased that the world is talking about IoT security, but I'm concerned that the message may be people perceive it's in hand and it's not.
Yeah, the problem may be that we're just talking about it.
Yep. No one did anything.
Yeah, right. Ken Monroe of Pentest Partners, thank you so much for coming on the Security Ledger podcast. It was great talking to you.
Hey, good on. Thank you.